Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., in which, the best I can tell, no love fest is underway. On today's show, culture warriors continue to divide the nation over the issue of same-gender marriage. But coming up later in the program, we'll hear about how many mainline Protestant clergy are changing their minds on this issue. Pollster Robbie Jones will be my guest shortly. I will ask him about his recent survey on clergy and gay and lesbian issues. And then in a change of pace, Robbie will ask me some questions as well. I am, after all, a clergy member myself, and I've recently written a paper on the issue of same-gender marriage, so I'll get to share some of my own thoughts when I get out of the host chair and into the hot seat. But first, religion writers from around the country gathered in Minneapolis this week for the annual meeting of the Religion News Writers Association. The Boston Globe's Michael Paulson was one of the writers that made the trip to the Twin Cities. But as Paulson wrote on his blog called Articles of Faith, the conference had a very different feel this year. Attendance was down, a result of layoffs and diminished travel budgets, all of which led him to wonder, is religion reporting an endangered beat? Michael joins me right now from his office at the Boston Globe. Michael, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you say that when you started covering religion for the Boston Globe, the beat was almost trendy. Newspapers were beefing up their coverage considerably. Religion sections were fat. And a few newspapers, like the Los Angeles Times, had four or more religion writers. I take it that we're living in a very different era today.
Absolutely. As you probably know, the newspaper industry has been under tremendous pressure. And many newspapers are cutting staffs, cutting the size of their papers physically, and having to reduce the number of subjects they cover. The problems in the newspaper industry are compounded by the problems in the economy, which, as everyone knows, has been in recession for some months now.
Michael, is this particular to religion sections that financially strapped papers consider this particular beat a luxury they can do without, or is it relate to all sections?
You know, it's an interesting question. Newspapers are making cutbacks across the board, and there are other specialty beats that are also suffering. But I also think religion is a beat that has had trouble transferring to the online world. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it's partly because it's not connected to some of the kinds of economic concerns that are associated with other beats. So I think religion is especially suffering, that some newspapers, unfortunately, when they're looking at what to cut back, they see religion as more of a luxury and other beats as more of a necessity.
Are there religion and news stories that are going underreported or unreported because of the situation?
It's a good question. I think the answer is that many things are being covered less than they were. In some cases, perhaps with good reason. But if you go now to a denominational convention of any major denomination in the U.S., from the Catholics to the Presbyterians to the Episcopalians, whoever, a few decades ago, there would have been several dozen reporters mm-hmm. from large secular newspapers. Now there are likely to be none. There'll be a couple reporters from wire services and then a bunch of bloggers from various interest groups within that faith tradition, and the denomination itself is probably covering itself. So mm-hmm. the Episcopal Church has the Episcopal News Service, which very aggressively covers everything that's going on in Episcopalianism in America.
Right.
But yes, it means that there are fewer sources of information in newspapers, so you're much more likely to see a story by the Associated Press than you are to see a story by your local religion reporter. And the Associated Press does a terrific job covering religion. It has some very talented reporters, but it means there are fewer voices, fewer sets of eyes and ears looking at these things, and I think we're all weaker for that.
My guess is that religion would be one of the hardest beats to cover, because we're talking about something incredibly personal, as well as a force that can impact people's lives and can do so for better or worse, shape society, politics, all of that. Do diminished resources and fewer reporters affect religion coverage in a way that's different than, say, the science section or the arts section? Is religion reporting different in that regard?
You're right that religion is a hard subject to cover, in part for the reasons that you cite, and in part because in some ways it's so different from everything else that newspapers cover, in the sense that the views that people describe aren't tangible and measurable in the way that, you know, something about transportation or education can be tested and described. And I think it's one of the reasons that newspapers have always struggled with religion coverage. But I also think that the beat matters so much to many of our readers, because, as you know, this is one of the most religious nations anywhere. And the subject hits people at home. It's something that people care about deeply. So I think newspapers suffer in the sense that they don't do as good a job reflecting their communities and the lives of their readers when they don't do a good job covering religion.
Michael Paulson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who covers religion for the Boston Globe. His blog is called Articles of Faith. Michael, thanks again for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief, and there's a lot more to come on today's program, including a look at opinions of same-gender marriage from clergy. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. This summer, we witnessed two landmark decisions made by mainline Protestant churches. The Episcopal Church voted in July to lift the ban on gay clergy and to begin laying groundwork for the blessing of same-sex unions. Declarations followed closely by a similar vote in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The country's largest Lutheran denomination said that it, too, would allow openly gay people to serve as clergy and in positions of church leadership. In fact, church leadership encouraged their congregations to recognize members in accountable, lifelong, monogamous, same-gender relationships. Now, these decisions, I don't have to tell you, remain highly controversial for the individual churches and the public. And they're not always evidence of an evolving view of homosexuality among mainline Protestant clergy. My guest today is not a stranger to you, Robbie Jones. Robbie Jones is the president and founder of Public Religion Research, a progressive polling organization which does great work, and recently, as a part of that work, released the most in-depth study ever conducted of theological and political attitudes among mainline clergy toward lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues in the church and society. Robbie joins me now in the studio to discuss this poll known as Clergy Voices Survey. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief.
All right, thanks, Reverend Getty. Glad to be here.
You concentrated your survey on mainline Protestant clergy. If you were to generalize here, are we talking about a more socially conservative or a more progressive group of clergy? Do these mainline leaders tend to be traditionalists, or what some people would call modernists, or was it divided?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing to say is that mainline Protestants are really a big tent denominational family. So you see a lot of diversity, a lot of variety. They are the third largest religious tradition in the U.S., making up about 18% of the country and about 19% of voters. So even though you don't see a lot of ink spilled these days about mainline Protestant clergy, they're in fact quite important in the American religious landscape. On the question of whether they're progressive or conservative, I do think one of, the, of its strengths is that it really is a repository for theological and social diversity. It's really one of the few places in our society that has the capacity for deliberation between a wide variety of perspectives and a number of diverse outlooks. But to give you variety here, so theologically, there is a strong support for social justice. So in terms of thinking about how they might be progressive, there's a strong support here. And a couple of issues to kind of flesh this out. Strong support for health care reform, for example. More than two-thirds agree that this is mainline Protestant clergy as a whole, that government should guarantee health insurance for all citizens, even if it means higher taxes. So willing to pay the price and willing to have this benefit. One final thing, in terms of politics, about half of mainline Protestant clergy identify as liberal, about 19% identify as moderate, and about a third say they're conservative. So you can see a wide range of beliefs here.
Well, and I think your characterization is right on target. You see the mainline clergy as actually more progressive than the general public on issues like you've just mentioned, but only a third support same-gender marriage. Now, why is marriage different? Is it a case of equal rights in society up until marriage, or is it theology? What is it?
Yeah. Well, I think among mainline Protestant clergy, you see exactly what you said. On a number of issues, more progressive than the general population, but on cultural issues such as abortion or same-gender marriage, pretty much in line with the general population and fairly in line with their parishioners as well. So what's different there? You know, I think a couple of things. It's worth pointing out before I get to marriage that mainline Protestant clergy are strongly supportive of other LGBT rights. So it is something about marriage. So if you go to workplace protections, hate crimes legislation, support for adoption rights, all of these enjoy strong majority support among mainline Protestant clergy. Where you see the difference is on the issue of marriage, but it's important to understand there are some real nuances here as well. So on the one hand, you do have only a third supporting, as you said, same-sex marriage, but you have nearly another third supporting civil unions and then about 35% saying no legal recognition at all. So one way of really understanding this is that nearly two-thirds support some legal recognition for gay and lesbian couples and only about 35% supporting none, and the differences are between civil union support and same-gender marriage support.
Now, another really, I think, very important dimension of your findings was that you found that support for marriage changes when clergy are told that they won't be forced to perform same-gender marriages. Tell me about those interviews.
Sure. You know, this is one of the most important findings that we had in the study, and it actually mirrors findings that we at Public Religion Research have found in the general population. So we see similar concerns about similar religious liberty concerns around this issue of same-gender marriage. So what we found is that support for same-gender marriage increases significantly when clergy were assured that no church or congregation would be required to perform same-gender marriages against its beliefs. So we called this in the report a religious liberty reassurance. And the reason we use the word reassurance is because these liberties actually, in fact, already exist in terms of religious liberty, as you well know. But what we saw is an increase by a 13-point increase in support for same-gender marriage when this reassurance was given. And what this really tells us is that a significant portion of that support for civil unions is, in fact, support for marriage with a deep concern about religious liberty.
Hmm. Now, I'm also fascinated by one other factor that was clear in your research, and that is, even though the numbers are not as high as some might want them to be on support for same-gender marriage, a majority supports allowing gays and lesbians to adopt children. Now, I find that odd because in some of the conversations that I have had, the grave concern is about what same-gender marriage does to children. So how does that reconcile? How does that play out?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing it tells you is that among this group, that concern is less of a concern, right? Yeah. And that, you know, the pattern that we generally see is that we see the strongest support for individual rights for gay and lesbian people. We see very strong support for workplace protections, hate crimes laws. Those involves rights that attach to an individual. The support for adoption is still strong majority support for adoption rights for gay and lesbian couples, but that support's a little lower than the support for rights. It's higher than the support for marriage, but lower than support for individual rights. Mm-hmm. And so you can see some evidence that those concerns are operative, so they're not nowhere. But they're not such trumping concerns as they are, as you may hear in other populations.
In mainline Protestantism, there are more female clergy that support same-gender marriage than male clergy. But there's also an increase in the numbers of female clergy. So statistically, is that relevant for the future of this debate?
I'm really glad you brought this up. This is something we almost missed, actually, in the initial analysis of the survey. Came to late in the analysis process. And when we saw it, it was one of those aha moments. Mm-hmm. So what you see, the mainline Protestant churches are also the churches where women clergy were first ordained in the country. So we have some history of female ordination among the mainline. And one thing to say is that these numbers have increased over the last decade. So we have actually data. Our survey actually mirrored surveys that were done in 1989 and 2001, and ours was done in 2008. So we have nearly 20 years of trend data to look back at some of these trends. What we found is that in 1989, only 7% of the clergy were women. Hmm. And by the time we get to 2008, that number is nearly tripled to 20%. It's really significant. It was stunning, frankly, that when we looked across, it didn't matter what issue we looked at, economic issues, cultural issues, we saw double-digit differences between men and women clergy, with the women clergy being more progressive consistently across the board, whether it was healthcare, the environment, whatever the issues were, you saw double-digit differences there. And when we got to cultural issues like abortion and same-gender marriage, we were looking at 30-point differences. So just on the one point of same-gender marriage here, we have nearly 6 in 10, 58% of female clergy believe that gay couples should be allowed to marry, compared to only about a quarter, 27% of male clergy. That's a very big difference.
I'm speaking with Robbie Jones from Public Religion Research about his recent survey on mainline clergy and their views on gay and lesbian issues. There's more to come after the break, and you're going to be stunned by some of those findings as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Welton Getty, and in studio with me is Robbie Jones, president of Public Religion Research. We're talking about Robbie's Clergy Voices poll, a survey of mainline Protestant clergy attitudes around gay and lesbian issues. Robbie, your survey shows an evolution in how this clergy group feels about issues related to gay and lesbian people. Tell us how attitudes have changed.
Sure. You know, what we know in the general population is that views on gay and lesbian issues have generally become more progressive over time. And this is something we see. You can see it in the generational effects now, that younger people have more progressive views on these issues than older people across the board. But we also had the benefit, as I mentioned in the earlier segment, of having two snapshots of mainline clergy in 1989 and 2001. So we were able to actually measure where they were, and we had some questions that were consistent over the surveys. We actually measured the differences over time. And we also had an interesting question on the survey where we asked clergy to think back themselves to where their views were 10 years ago and to give us an estimate of how their views had changed in their own estimation. And we found consistent things, not surprising, but consistent things. Between 2001 and 2008, for example, we had a question that said gays and rights gays and lesbians should have all the same rights and privileges as other American citizens. The numbers were already fairly high in 2001. 70% of mainline clergy agreed with that assessment in 2001, but it had climbed 9 more points by 2008 up to 79%. So we have 8 in 10 clergy agreeing with this general statement about the gay and lesbian person should have all the same rights and privileges as other American citizens. And when we ask clergy to think back about their own trajectories here and estimate their own, how their views had changed, we had, again, nearly half confirming that their views on gay and lesbian issues were more liberal today than they were 10 years ago. We had about 4 in 10 saying they hadn't changed, but only 14% saying they'd become more conservative.
I know that a lot of clergy say, and this is important because actually it is a partial explanation of a pilgrimage on which I found myself, that one thing that impacts a change of attitudes regarding gay and lesbian people is knowing gay and lesbian people, having a relationship with them that lets you discover who they are as persons. Now, there are those who continue to have a very conservative stance on gay and lesbian issues who actually report they don't know any gay people. Now, how is that possible?
Well, that's what they report. You know, we certainly see this. But, you know, the important thing that you point to here is that you see a very clear trajectory that people who report that they themselves are gay or lesbian, or they have a close friend or a family member, or in the case of clergy, interestingly enough, a coworker, which means they have a fellow minister on staff mm-hmm. at church, mm-hmm. That those are the strongest predictors of more open and welcoming and affirming views about gay and lesbians across on any issue you want to look at, pretty much, that those were the strongest influences. They were stronger than and the other influences were like biblical views on biblical literalism. But these views about knowing someone gay or lesbian compete with those views pretty one-to-one. And that's a really interesting – you know, we could have a whole theological conversation right. about what – seeing someone and sitting across the table and sharing a communion table with someone what the impact of that is on one's theological views and what work that does. But we clearly see it in the data. It's really an interesting aspect of this whole area.
I don't want to ever reduce complexity to simplicity. But in the big picture, there really does seem to be two polar opposites among mainline clergy that is directly are directly related to how clergy read the Bible. Whether on the conservative side, clergy read the Bible as a condemnation of homosexuality, or on the progressive side, clergy find a message of inclusion in the Bible that says we should welcome everyone into the church and in society. From your listening, is that a fair assessment of the situation, or am I still reducing it to a simplicity that doesn't get at it?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. When we've done other analysis in the general population as well about done like regression analysis to try to tease out these what are the independent predictors of one's view on same gender marriage, and the two that really do leap out and that compete with one another are the two things you've just mentioned. Knowing someone, and not just knowing someone, but actually having a close relationship, that's what really matters, that being a friend, a coworker, a family member who is gay or lesbian, and how one reads the Bible. And, you know, what we see is, I think in some people, those two things wrestle with one another. In some cases, one of those trumps the other. And the question is, in the sort of words of C.S. Lewis, actually, that E.J. Dionne brought up in our recent press conference that we just held on religious activists, sometimes the question is, as C.S. Lewis said, are we actually just reading the Bible to read into it our own political views, or are we reading it the other way around? So.
Yeah. Well, let's don't go there right now.
It's a complex issue. But I would say to your question, I think it's complex. I think these two things, in listening to other ministers, I've heard someone say, people who are torn, I'm sometimes stuck between compassion and obedience, mm-hmm. right? And for people who read the Bible in a fairly literal way, this is a real struggle.
I'm speaking with Robbie Jones from Public Religion Research about his recent survey on mainline clergy and their views on gay and lesbian issues. We're concentrating on the issue of gay marriage here. We've got to take another quick break, but when we come back, I hate to tell you this, we're actually going to switch places, and Robbie is going to interview me about this issue. I tried to have us run out of time, but I didn't ask enough questions, so stay tuned, and we're going to reverse chairs and continue. We'll be right back.
Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. I've been speaking today with Robbie Jones from Public Religion Research. Robbie's the author of a survey called Clergy Voices about changing attitudes towards gay and lesbian issues among mainline Protestant clergy. It's a survey that I relied on heavily while working on a paper that I've recently written on the issue of same-gender marriage. I want to thank Robbie for his research and for subsequently reading the paper that I published. Robbie, your work has been tremendously helpful.
Well, thanks, Welton. Thanks for having me on and allowing me to sit over on the other side of the table and ask some questions of you. Certainly want to take this opportunity to ask a couple of questions about your insightful paper. It's called Same Gender Marriage and Religious Freedom, A Call to Quiet Conversations and Public Debates. I guess I'll just start with the first thing you say in the paper, and that is, don't start with religion. You say you want to shift the debate over gender marriage from a scriptural argument to a religious freedom argument. What do you really mean by that?
I really mean let's don't start with religion. And that is a strategy for getting into a civil conversation that has the promise of finding some common ground on which we can stand and talk even more closely. I can't think of a single issue on which the people of this nation could come to consensus if you start talking about it from the perspective of religion. So I think if we're ever going to move forward, we've got to stop beginning with Scripture, whatever the interpretation. That's not where to start. The issue is legal, not spiritual, and it needs to start with the Constitution, not the Quran or the Bible or another holy scripture.
Okay, so I think I've got don't start with religion. But now this makes some sense. Let's say you said on any issue, right, this is what you would say,
yeah.
Don't start with religion. So you might say—
If you're talking about government.
Right.
Well, yeah, okay.
Yeah, legal issues,
right.
So don't start with religion. Right. You know, now it's one thing to say that about healthcare reform. It's another thing that we're talking about marriage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little trickier issue. So one question would be, how do you avoid that with something like marriage, which
mm-hmm.
has been in many ways intertwined between civil and religious in our country's history? How would you propose doing that with the issue of marriage?
Well, I think you begin by dealing with the last observation that you just made, which is very correct, and that is that in the history of our country, at least, the religious views and the political views and the legal views have all become so intertwined that it's very difficult to discern what is religious and what is political or legal. In this nation, religion is a non-factor today in whether or not a couple can get married. The issue is purely legal. The only way that a minister, a rabbi, an imam, any religious leader can conduct a wedding, a marriage ceremony, and the results of that officiation be acceptable to the government is if that religious leader serves as a representative of the government. It is not as a representative of religion, but as a representative of government that the person has the authority to do the ceremony. So one of the first acts in getting at the issues at stake here is, yes, if you ask me, if you came to my office in the church that I pastor and said, is there a religious dimension to marriage? I would say, absolutely, there is. If you said, does one have to embrace your religious view of marriage in order to get married in this nation? I would say no, because this nation doesn't look at a particular religious position on it. Now, that has been intentionally made more ambiguous by politicians, particularly, who don't want to take the heat of saying we need to separate this issue into its civil components and into its religious components.
So what would that mean exactly if we looked at the role of religious institutions then? How would it look maybe different than it does today? And maybe you could just describe what role, if any, you think religious institutions would play in this kind of shift that you're talking about.
Well, and that question is an invitation to go to the very center of the argument that I make in the paper, and that is that we need to be looking at this issue through the lens of religious liberty. I don't want to deny any religious tradition the right or opportunities to discuss marriage as a religious right within their tradition and all of the meaning of the spiritual meaning of it. But if it is a legal issue, then that's where we need to start. So let's start there. As a legal issue, if it is a right in our society offered under the Constitution, then it ought to be available to everybody. So as a very pragmatic way of getting at that, I would say that we ought to tell our government, stay out of our religious traditions and take care of your own stuff. And your own stuff is providing equal rights for all citizens. That means offer an opportunity for marriage, civil marriage, to everybody in the government. But don't meddle with what religious houses of worship want to do. If they want to oppose this, let them oppose it. It's interesting, Robbie, that some of the best insight into how we ought to handle marriage comes from how we handle divorce. Because in divorce, the government recognizes a divorce from people who say they want to get divorced. Now, the Roman Catholic Church does not recognize that divorce. There are other traditions that don't recognize it. The same thing can be true of marriage. I have told people I don't think they ought to get married, and because I don't think they ought to get married, I don't do the ceremony. Nobody has ever beat me up because of that. And so the government ought to do what the government does, and that is offer people the opportunity to get married. And if a house of worship wants that to be only for heterosexual people exclusively, they can do that. But if there's a house of worship that wants to perform a wedding ceremony for people of the same gender, they ought to have the right to do that.
Yep. So, Reverend Getty, so you and I are both former Southern Baptists. We're sitting here. One question I want to ask is along these lines. I grew up in Mississippi. You were in Louisiana. How do you expect this argument to be taken by those in more conservative faith traditions, such as Christian evangelicals, Southern Baptists, Mormons, and others?
I think I expect to be misunderstood, but I expect that with the hope that there will be some people who will listen. I think it actually preserves the sanctity of marriage to keep marriage in houses of worship in a form that is consistent with their theology and their practice. That means some are going to not perform same-gender marriages. It means that others are. What I would hope is that among Christian evangelicals, and particularly among Southern Baptists, because you're right, look, I learned my passion for religious freedom in a Southern Baptist church, because in what's called the historic Baptist tradition, that was a fundamental component of that tradition, separation of church and state. And I'm trying here to be true to the promise of the Constitution with its division of religion and government institutionally, in order that each can perform with integrity the services it ought to perform. And so all I ask among these kinds of traditions is give it a listen. We're not trying to impose anything on you. We're trying to preserve the Constitution, which lets you have the freedom to be the religious person you want to be. Well, Robbie, on that note, let me thank you again for your interest in the Green Paper and for allowing me to share some of my own thoughts. And also, thanks for being with us again today on State of Belief to share your own findings. Robbie Jones is the president and founder of Public Religion Research, and he's recently released the most in-depth study ever conducted of theological and political attitudes among mainline clergy toward lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues in the church and society. Robbie, it's always a pleasure to have you on State of Belief.
Thanks, Weldon. Thanks for your fantastic work as well.
Well, that's our show for today. You want to get in touch with us? You want to tell us what you think? Look, we want you to tell us what you think. Go then to stateofbelief.com and send us an email. Or remember, you can call us. Record your thoughts. The number is 202-238-3291. Once again, 202-238-3291. As I always must remind you, State of Belief is brought to you every week by the Interfaith Alliance. If you care about protecting religious diversity in this country, then you ought to care about the Interfaith Alliance. In fact, you ought to become a member. You can do that. Go to Interfaith Alliance to learn more. Make sure to tune in next week. All new conversations about religion, politics, culture, and who knows what else may be. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.